From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Researchers from Oxford University and the drug maker AstraZeneca say today in the medical journal The Lancet that their vaccine induced strong antibody and T-cell immune responses in a study of more than 1,000 people. Positive news that comes as more than 600,000 deaths from COVID-19 are reported around the world.
An epicenter of the pandemic in this country is Florida, where more than 80% of the state's ICU beds are full, following five straight days with over 10,000 new cases a day. For more, we're joined now by Dr. Mary Jo Trepka, professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology at Florida International University. Welcome, doctor.
Hello.
So Florida's Agency for Healthcare Administration said today that four out of five ICU beds are occupied in the state. How dire is the situation in Florida right now?
Well, Florida has seen a sustained increase in the number of cases of COVID-19. This has been going on for several weeks, and it originally started with especially younger people. Median age was in the early 30s, like about 33 or so. And as time has gone on, we have seen an increase in the median age now at 41. So the people who are becoming infected now are older, which is not so surprising. It seemed like some of the behavior of the younger people early on was fueling the transmission. But of course, young people are not isolated. And it seems now that more older people have become infected. Older people, they're more likely to become hospitalized and also more likely to die of COVID-19. So we're seeing also more severe cases. And so, yes, the hospitals right now are being strained. Here in Miami-Dade County, the hospitals have canceled all elective procedures, so that that's frees up ventilators and also ICU beds. The hospitals have been able to keep up, but at great strain. They can manage some more, but they were really, really are in a very difficult situation right now, with the problem not being so much ICU beds or ventilators, but also a shortage of trained staff.
You mentioned the behaviors of younger people. Broward and Miami-Dade counties in South Florida have now put curfews into effect and limited private gatherings to 10 people. Are those emergency orders going to slow the spread, or do you feel like it's a little too late?
They're not the first measures. A couple weeks ago, the governor did close down the bars, and that was very important. Then the other thing was here in South Florida, in Miami-Dade County in particular, indoor dining was banned, mandatory masks with fines. We are starting to see in South Florida a slight decrease in the increase in the number of cases. So it seems like those measures are starting to take effect. The problem is, of course, we're already at a very high level and we're not at the peak yet. So it is going to be very challenging for the hospitals to cope with all the cases. I think there has been kind of a lack of a unified message statewide, and people have been confused. That's one problem.
Doctor, I want to ask you more about those policy decisions. On ABC yesterday, Democratic Representative Donna Shalala blamed the situation in Florida on what she called a lack of leadership in the White House and the governor's office. Let's listen.
They simply have not hit this with a hammer, which is what we needed to do, and starve the virus. They opened too soon, and they misunderstand what you need to do, or they understand it and they're not willing to do it.
You alluded to this, the different messaging that people in Florida are receiving. How much of this current spike could have been avoided if the state had taken stronger action sooner?
Yes, I think one thing that happened after what was really kind of a very brief lockdown is that people thought this was behind them when it was not behind them or not behind us. And so people were having graduation parties. Memorial Day was one big party. And I think there was a lot of transmission that resulted from that. At least that's sort of what the data would indicate. And I think people need to understand that this is not the same thing as deciding to wear your seatbelt or not wear your seatbelt. It's not that we are only hurting ourselves because we're exposing ourselves to risk, but we hurt everybody that we come in contact with. Because if I become infected and I don't even know that I'm infected, I can expose other people around me, even people who might be very vulnerable. The chain of transmission goes on and on and on and on. So each of us has to interrupt it now at this point.
That's Mary Jo Trepka, professor and chair of the Department of Epidemiology at Florida International University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump gave an astonishing interview to Fox News Sunday yesterday, host Chris Wallace repeatedly challenging Trump's false claims about COVID-19, including that the U.S. has the best death rate in the world. It does not. And that more testing is why there's been an explosion of cases.
Testing is up 37%.
Well, that's 30, good.
I understand. Cases are up 194%. It isn't just that testing has gone up. It's that the virus has spread. The positivity rate has increased.
Many of those cases are young people that would heal in a day. They have the sniffles, and we put it down as a test.
Of course, those snifflers are spreaders. The president also called coronavirus task force member Dr. Anthony Fauci a bit of an alarmist, seeming to back an op-ed last week by White House trade advisor Peter Navarro, who blamed Fauci for faults in fighting COVID-19. And the New York Times reported a strategy by the president and his team to shift fighting the virus over to states in order to deflect blame from Trump, and said the White House was enabled by rosy projections from task force member Dr. Deborah Birx. Let's bring in Margaret Talov, White House and politics editor at Axios. Margaret, what's your sense of what's going on in the White House?
Robin, these three data points that you're pulling out, right? The Chris Wallace interview, the New York Times is reporting, and the dynamic with Peter Navarro, they're all of a piece and they fit together. And it is a situation where President Trump is looking to kind of indemnify himself against blame for the massive, human cost and economic cost of the pandemic. The dynamic with Peter Navarro is very interesting. He's an aggressive trade hawk and anti-China rhetorician and policymaker. He's had the president's ear since the campaign. He's very controversial inside the White House, and often he is tugging the president to the right. But interestingly enough, in the case of the coronavirus, it was Peter Navarro himself, we've reported, who very early on, like late January and then into February, was privately trying to tell the president in memos, look out, you have to take this thing seriously. It could result in the loss of 1 million, maybe 2 million American lives if we don't take this seriously. Publicly, he was not as clear about those concerns at all, but privately, that was the message he was giving, the president himself brushing it off. Now to see these tables turned and Navarro going after Fauci has been very interesting. And people say, why does the president allow him to do this? The president sort of publicly goaded into dissenting himself and saying, well, that was just one person speaking. He shouldn't have been doing that. But the fact of the matter is that this is like not the first time Peter Navarro has done something controversial or kind of gone off script. The president likes having him around. He likes the perspective he brings, and he likes it that Peter Navarro will always say something more controversial than what the president's saying, allowing the president to kind of have this perception of moderation or middle ground.
Well, it's been reported that Peter Navarro overruled the objections of an influential Republican senator who wanted to stop U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia as it wages its proxy war in Yemen. And there are a lot of critics of that proxy war, killing so many civilians in Yemen. But Navarro was arguing that we needed the sales for American jobs and, you know, the American bottom line. So he obviously has a lot of power. He has claimed his PhD in economics makes him as qualified as Fauci to weigh in on coronavirus treatments like hydroxychloroquine, which he has backed. That's troubling. But as you said, he also tried to warn President Trump about COVID-19 and that he should take it seriously. But I guess what does this say to you about the Trump White House and its approach to COVID-19 in general, that we have this trade advisor somehow rising in this way?
Well, this is of a piece with one of the central dynamics and the central narratives in the way President Trump has governed, which is that he does not accept institutional tradition, that he likes to have paths outside of a central path, that You know, in a typical White House, the chief of staff is the most important advisor, the gatekeeper who keeps people in and out, who decides who sees the president, what documents get in front of the president. President Trump has upended that. And when you would have an economic advisor, a trade advisor, weighing in heavily on foreign policy as it relates to China, on military policy as it relates to arms sales, on health policy as it relates to coronavirus, you know, the buck doesn't stop with Peter Navarro. The buck stops with the president, who has enabled these conversations. So I think this is very much bolstering what we already know about President Trump, is he likes to hear the opinions that he likes to hear and the advice that he likes to hear. And he likes people who are willing to say controversial things as long as he feels that they're loyal to him. And Peter Navarro fits the bill in all of these ways.
Margaret Tal of White House and politics editor at Axios. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. Simons-Rock.edu/now, where independent minds get their start.
Of the four Minneapolis police officers charged in the killing of George Floyd, only Derek Chauvin, who pressed his knee on Floyd's neck, is charged with second-degree murder. J. Alexander Kang, To Tao, and Thomas Lane are each charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder and manslaughter because they didn't intervene to stop Chauvin. Several cities have since scrambled to mandate duty-to-intervene directives, meaning officers have to try to stop unwarranted force. But Minneapolis already had that policy. And the family of Officer Kang, who is Black, is stunned. They say he joined the force to change it from the inside, to stop excessive force. His lawyer says he did tell Chauvin he should stop, but he didn't stop him. In a moment, we'll speak with Baltimore's new police commissioner, Michael Harrison, about teaching police to intervene. But meanwhile, to answer the question, why don't they? Arthur Reiser is a former police officer. He's now at R Street, the conservative libertarian think tank. And Arthur, you say this is a relatively simple answer to the question.
You're right. It is a simple solution to a very complex problem, which is you have to change police culture. And that's very, very difficult.
You know, it's something called the Wall of Blue, the Code of Silence. Other professions also have a duty to intervene. A doctor has one if he sees another doctor doing something wrong. A lawyer has one. But police are like the military. Everyone is armed, and you depend on them to have your back. You know, it might be harder to call someone out. Also, there's a hierarchy. Chauvin had been a police officer with Minneapolis police for nearly 19 years. Kang was on his third shift. Another officer, Thomas Lane, had been on the force for 4 days. Chauvin was their training officer on the scene.
So I think you hit the nail on the head in the sense that it is incredibly difficult to not only consider yourself a rookie, and when you're a rookie, you're indoctrinated, you're hazed into the idea that you don't know anything. I mean, every FTO says this to every rookie when you get into your car. I know what they taught you in the academy, but I'm going to tell you how to actually be a cop. So it is an incredible pressure to put on someone to correct their FTO when they're seeing something. Maybe they know something that I don't know. You know, he's been in the mix a lot more than I have. He has fought for his life more than likely. I think all of those add to the complexity of what actually played out on that horrible day in Minneapolis.
Well, and again, the thinking could also be, if I do this, I'm going to be the rap.
We've always had this sense that you do not rat on your fellow officer, your fellow plumber, your fellow whatever. It's something kind of ingrained into us.
How should duty to intervene work? You say there are exceptions.
Well, there is the general law, actus reus, and generally speaking, you do not have to intervene in something. That's just, if I saw you drowning, I am not obligated to try to rescue you. You know, if I'm the one that got you in a situation where you were drowning, I would have to intervene. And when you're talking about the duty to intervene with officers, what you're really saying is that you are criminally culpable if you do not act. That actually goes against the vast majority of our jurisprudence. Listen, if you carry a gun, there's certain responsibility that comes along with that. And one of those is you should intervene if you see something going sideways.
Well, but officers have and been fired for it. In Chicago, Lorenzo Davis says he was fired for not backing off his conclusion that police were not justified in some shooting. A court, a jury, awarded him $2 million. He hasn't seen it yet. But he says this kind of duty to intervene absolutely makes you a pariah. What do you think has to happen to somehow crack that code?
We need the core leadership within police departments to fundamentally change the way they think about policing. I've actually, you know, interviewed police officers, and most do not believe that their job is prestigious. But by changing that mentality and using them as the key to switch police culture, I think can go a long way.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering if you think there's been some change. You know, there was a video of Crystal Smith, the black Fort Lauderdale police officer, who yelled at her white colleague who was roughing up a peaceful protester. She chased him off, you know, and her police chief stood by her and suspended the white officer.
Yeah, because transparency is the key to fixing culture. And right now, there's more light, you know, being shined down on policing than ever before. The fact is that police now are better than they ever have been. So do I have hope? I absolutely have hope. But we need to ensure that they have the right tools and the right support in order to do the right thing.
Arthur Reiser, a former police officer and current director of criminal justice and civil liberties policy at R Street, the conservative libertarian think tank. Arthur, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, now to Michael Harrison, Baltimore police commissioner since January. Before that, he was in New Orleans, where he instituted the EPIC, or Ethical Policing is Courageous program, developed by Professor Irvin Staub at UMass Amherst. Now, both cities were under Justice Department investigations that led to consent decrees, promises to revamp their departments. So, commissioner, now at Baltimore, what is EPIC?
EPIC, or Ethical Policing is Courageous, is based on the science of active versus passive bystandership. People who see something, they either choose to do nothing or they choose to do something or intervene. And so we now convert that to policing, where we are teaching and have taught in New Orleans and will be very soon here in Baltimore, teaching police officers how to intervene on the part of their colleagues when we see another officer escalating or headed down a wrong path to make a decision that they or all of us will regret.
You say you're trying to create loyalty to the other officer on the front end, not on the back end after something's happened, but before it has.
Right. That is correct. And so what we have done historically in the profession is ask officers to cover for us when we make mistakes. EPIC teaches us how to have the appropriate display of loyalty by stepping in before a bad act happens, thereby showing loyalty on the front end, as you've mentioned. It saves an injury, it saves a broken relationship between police and community, and it saves an officer's career.
And so how does it work? We understand it's not just a lecture in a classroom. It's something almost physical to, I guess, create cell memory. How does it work?
It does create what we call muscle memory. That is correct. First of all, we teach the science of bystandership, active versus passive. And we teach about the dangers of what happens when we fail to intervene versus what we achieve when we actually intervene. Then we go through active scenarios, hands-on scenarios, where the officers are taught how to intervene and step between perhaps a citizen and another officer, even in the case of a higher rank. And the department has to have a strong anti-retaliation policy so as to not have retaliation or ostracize members when they actually do that.
And so are you talking about actual skits? Physically, you'll have them act that out. Could be grabbing an arm that's raised. It could be physically stopping them.
It could be. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But the goal of the intervention should occur long before that, when tone of voice and body language begin to escalate to suggest that it could go to that. We want to intervene long before it ever gets to a person who is about to strike.
Wow. Look, you have had success with this in New Orleans. The complaints of officer use of force have gone down. Now you're in Baltimore. where the Justice Department found officers routinely made unconstitutional stops, searches, and arrests disproportionately affecting African Americans. You know, they knew you were coming in, having instituted this in New Orleans. What are you hearing from cops?
So cops are anticipating that this is coming. And so what we're hearing is that it is much needed. There probably will be some skepticism at first, but this is a program for officers by officers. We're looking for officers to sell it to their colleagues and their friends. And it prevents me from having to use and to disseminate discipline because we're actually preventing bad acts from happening.
Does there also, Commissioner, have to be more celebration of officers who do intervene? We mentioned the officer, a woman, who chased away a white officer when he started to attack a passive protester. Her chief of police celebrated her.
When you want to change culture, you have to change the reward system. And we often reward, you know, saving lives. I applaud that chief for openly celebrating an officer who intervenes. Because we all have a duty to intervene, but beyond duty, we should be doing it because it is the right thing to do.
Well, Commissioner, we know that there are so many police officers who tirelessly work to protect civilians, but we are talking about the use of excessive force and a duty to intervene, and that lack of intervention happens disproportionately to blacks. You are a black man, and there's culture here, but there's also history. Police were used to track down runaway slaves, you know that, or charge freed slaves with unwarranted fees to re-enslave them, then later to racially profile blacks or stop and frisk. You know, this was a culture of keeping blacks in their place. It was a job that was assigned to America's police. How do you change that cultural DNA where it still exists?
Well, first of all, many police officers don't really understand the history. It begins to be an issue of educating our officers on the history of policing. And number two, talking about the damage that it has done and it has caused and what happens when poor public policy translate into over-incarceration or incarceration of wrong people for the wrong reasons. Then we have to have policies that deal with implicit bias and make sure we can overcome our biases. And then we have to make sure that there's good supervision to make sure that officers are following the Constitution and the performance of their duty. And then obviously documenting that so that we can have quality assurance that we did it right.
That's Baltimore Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. Thank you so much, Commissioner Harrison, and best of luck to you there in Baltimore.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And tomorrow, a police officer who says she was fired when she intervened to stop excessive force by a cop who was later jailed for excessive force. That's tomorrow, here and now.
Workers in nearly 200 cities are walking out today in what's being called the Strike for Black Lives. From Memphis to San Francisco, the strike includes nursing home staff, fast food cooks, and other frontline workers, all demanding racial and economic justice. We're joined now by Mary Kay Henry. She's president of the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU. And Mary Kay, tens of thousands of workers from all over the country striking. Give us a picture of who's out there and what they're asking for.
Well, essential workers that have been on the front lines of this pandemic were incredibly inspired by the Movement for Black Lives response to the murder of George Floyd and decided enough is enough. We have to unite our fights across racial justice and economic justice and demand more. Fast food cooks, nursing home workers, janitors, Uber, Lyft drivers, Google engineers are joining together and saying we have to do better. Corporations just can't say they are for Black lives. Corporations have to show it by paying Black, Brown, Asian, and white workers living wages, 2 weeks of paid sick leave. We want to root out systemic racism in employment, and we want to root it out of criminal justice as well.
What have you heard from SEIU employees about their working conditions right at this moment?
I have to say, Tanya, my blood boils about what I hear. Nursing home workers are still struggling to get personal protective equipment. Fast food workers are being told to wear doggy diapers instead of being provided masks by their employers when infections
occur. And are these major corporations? I'm just this doggy diaper request. I mean, that's astounding.
Yes. Yes, that was a McDonald's store in Oakland. It is astounding. And in San Francisco, they were told to wear coffee filters. And in Florida, they're told to use one mask for an entire week. But it's not just a failure of corporations, as you know. President Trump failed by not making sure that every essential worker and teachers, et cetera, have the equipment they need to keep themselves safe.
McDonald's has responded to accusations that they're not keeping their employees safe by saying that they have provided PPE and over 100 million masks to its employees. But what I'm hearing from you is that is not enough. This strike has brought major unions, including yours, together with grassroots social justice campaigns, plus climate change action groups like the Sunrise Movement. You've been the head of the SEIU for 10 years now. How significant is it to see all of these groups joining forces for this effort?
I think it's a historic moment, a new level of intersection between our fights. And the other thing that's significant, Tanya, is that the labor movement is owning that until Black communities can thrive, none of us can thrive. And that's a new shift that's occurred by virtue of the crisis and danger that people are facing, understanding that we have to join together and use our power to make demands on our government and corporations and then show up and vote in November and elect people at every level of government that see this as a transformational moment and are willing to make bold change with us.
That's Mary Kay Henry, president of the Service Employees International Union. Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. A fight over the next round of coronavirus aid is coming to a head as the Republican-controlled Senate and Democrat-led House of Representatives begin hammering out a new relief package before enhanced unemployment benefits run out for tens of millions of unemployed Americans. Last week, we spoke to Deidre Blakely, a Milwaukee casino worker who was laid off in March. She says she's been trying to get unemployment benefits since then and failing. She described for us her many fruitless calls to the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development.
You're calling back to back for about an hour straight. Once you finally get in queue, you're probably on hold for about 2.5 hours, if you're lucky. And if you're lucky, you don't get hung up on.
We reached out to that department and we're joined now by Caleb Frostman, the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, and he joins us now via Skype. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I know you can't speak to Deidre's specific case, but there's no doubt you've heard this story before. Deidre is a laid-off worker. She's waited to be called back to work, unable to get unemployment for months. She's been on hold for hours, getting different stories from different people. Why is this happening? Why can't she get through?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, from our side, it's been, you know, really unprecedented volume has been the biggest contributor to the issues that we're seeing as far as, you know, claims processing times, you know, phone call volume. You know, just in the 4 months since the pandemic, Wisconsin has seen about 4.5 million weeks of unemployment claimed here in the state. And just for context, in all of last year, it was about 1.6 million weeks claimed in the state. So the economic impact of COVID-19 has just had astronomical impacts on obviously the economy, but then also on folks filing for unemployment. So we've worked really hard to add more staff to process more claims more quickly and answer phone calls. And we're seeing solid progress, but it's still a challenge with the mountain of claims that have come in since the middle of March.
Okay, can you be more specific for us? So we're reading that your department still hasn't processed claims for about 150,000 people, many of whom have been waiting since March. Is that 150,000 number accurate? And how many additional workers do you have now working to work through those backlog of claims?
Our most recent data shows it's about 140,000 claimants that have a hold on their claim, and tens of thousands, we think about 40,000 of those, have actually not filed a weekly claim. So about 100,000 have, you know, a potential payment that is pending based on the determination from adjudication. And so we're working hard to get through that. We've added about 1,300 or 1,400 people. We started the pandemic at around 500 personnel in unemployment insurance. And since mid-March, we've ramped that up to 1,800 or 1,900, depending on the day. We've had some attrition in our call centers, but we've added contractors for adjudication, for claims processing, of course, for answering calls, then have hired permanent staff, as well as project and LTE personnel to help deal with the historic volume of claims here in Wisconsin.
Are you saying that it's the sheer number of claims that's really the reason why we're seeing this backlog and people not being able to get through? Are there other systemic problems, and how are you all tackling those problems?
Yeah, so it's been a combination of things. It's definitely the volume is kind of first and foremost, just based on the historical number. And a piece of it also is most unemployment insurance programs in the country are federally funded. And a big piece of that funding formula is your standard economic indicators like unemployment rate for that area. And so when we went from a 3% unemployment rate in March to a 13% unemployment rate in April, that funding formula didn't catch up fast enough to adjust for the staff we needed. So we've been working to add those folks to make that happen. Of course, not fast enough for us. It's not fast enough for anyone. The folks that are waiting on their payments, we won't, be satisfied until every eligible claimant gets paid every dollar they're owed, including back pay. But Wisconsin also has, over the last 8 years, passed a lot of laws that, perhaps unnecessarily complicate the unemployment insurance process. And then Wisconsin is also saddled with a 50-year-old mainframe IT system that made it very difficult to roll out the new federal programs in a timely manner.
Are there any actions on the horizon to help bring that system to the current day?
Yeah, so we were looking at modernizing very seriously for quite some time. So these lessons were learned coming out of the Great Recession, and they were not heeded, and we're seeing some challenges around this. We're hopeful that this horrible economic catastrophe and the impacts of these older systems can be put to good use going forward with some urgency around modernizing systems.
Yeah. Caleb Frostman is the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We put a call out to you to ask how the unemployment benefit process has gone for you where you live. And many of you, like Deidre Blakely, are sharing your frustrations and questions with us. Today we hear from two mothers who shared their stories.
My name is Betsy Ball. I have an address in Ohio, in Worcester, Ohio, but currently I'm in Westcliff, Colorado. My husband and daughter and I have a small travel business called Euro Travel Coach, and we help people travel to Europe until the pandemic. And we've been couch surfing since March, since we came back from Europe, because we have no home. We sold our home 3 years ago so that we could travel 9 months a year in Europe and then go to Canada, and the Canadian border is currently closed. We have a small place in Canada and we can't get there right now. So we've been spending time bouncing from friends and families. My husband and I were able to apply for pandemic unemployment assistance through the state of Ohio, and we have been receiving that. But my daughter, who is a partner in our business, her residence is in Wisconsin, and she also applied at the same time that we did and still has not heard a response from the state of Wisconsin. So why are we able to get a response from the state and our partner in the business has not been able to do the same thing? Another question I would have is, how is this going to carry on with the surges in the coronavirus going around the country? Is there going to be an extension? I know this completely depends on what the federal government decides to do in relation to the CARES Act, but we're just waiting to see. And the additional payments are up at the end of July. We're really wondering what's going to happen then.
My name is Jenny Fisher, and I live in Richmond, Virginia. I am currently unemployed, so I'm a stay-at-home mom right now. So going into May, I was offered a position at an advertising agency I was working at, but there was a hiring freeze. They cut freelancers in mid-April. Applying for unemployment was very confusing. And I feel like it's meant to be like that in some ways, that it's meant to be confusing for people, because I would have quit if I didn't need it as badly as we did. And there's no answers for it. You can't get through on hotlines. So you just kind of had to feel your way through it and kind of press on. But I have been being paid weekly. I get $150 from the state of Virginia, which is not sustainable. We're a family of four. And we're also in a sticky place where I am looking for work right now because I do want to go back to work. But also our school system just made the call to have all the children stay home virtually for the first semester of school. I don't know what to do. The CARES Act ends and I'm forced to go back to work or find something, or I stay home with my children and we face not being able to pay our rent, not being able to, you know, pay any debt. We might not be able to buy food. It's a really scary position to be in. So I would love to have answers about, like, are they going to be extending CARES Act? Like, are they going to do another stimulus check? What is going to happen? What are they doing for working parents? I feel privileged. There are a lot of single parents. There are a lot of teachers that have children. What are they going to do?
That was Jenny Fisher and Betsy Ball, two mothers who are unemployed and still haven't had their questions answered about relief. Share your experiences with us at hereandnow.org.
And to Oregon now, where State Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum has filed a lawsuit alleging that federal law enforcement officers sent to Portland to suppress Black Lives Matter protesters are violating the Constitution by detaining and arresting demonstrators without probable cause. Portland officials say the federal government is using unnecessary force and exacerbating unrest in the ongoing protests. The Trump administration says the city has lost control. So, can the federal government deploy forces and detain protesters without a state's consent or, as the suit charges, without probable cause? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He's here as he is every Monday. And so, Derek, witnesses say these officers are often in unmarked cars. They don't wear badges or identify themselves. Acting Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security Ken Cuccinelli told CNN this morning that's not true. But either way, are the officers there illegally? Is this legal?
Yes, I'm going to answer that question in just a second. Before I do want to draw a distinction between what I think is appropriate and what I gather to be legal. So the news coming out of Portland to me seems entirely morally indefensible. But as to its legality, I think it's a much murkier issue. So Trump has signed an executive order that empowers a lot of different agencies to essentially protect federal property and ensure safety in America's streets. Customs and Border Protection, ICE, Border Patrol, all these agencies, they have broad powers, vague powers, and those powers have been expanded after 9/11 to deal with a variety of different criminal activity. So the acting commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, the CBP, has said that his agency is dealing with, quote, criminals in Portland. And legally, given the expansion, expansive definition of our borders, CBP does have authority to operate in Portland. So this is all going to go before a judge, and I'm not a judge. And so the legality of this is going to be worked out by somebody else with a law degree. But I think the safest answer to your question, which is a really important question, is to say that what is happening in Portland is, I believe, morally wrong, but it is legally murky. And so it's going to be difficult to figure out exactly how the legality of it's going to be worked out.
And we should say the lawsuit brought by the Attorney General is focusing on probable cause and cites four agencies: the Department of Homeland Security, you mentioned Customs and Border Protection, the U.S. Marshals Service, and the Federal Protection Service. And Attorney General Rosenblum is going to try to get a temporary restraining order. Is that likely?
It is likely she's going to try. I don't know if the restraining order is going to work. Federal agents can detain people if they assert probable cause of a federal crime being committed. So destruction of federal property, for example, or if public safety is also in the general interest. Based on everything that I'm reading, there are many people who seem to be who are being detained who don't appear to be committing federal crimes, at least nothing that is visible on tape. That would make those detentions technically unconstitutional, which might make that restraining order being filed by the Attorney General likely. Again, though, these agencies have really broad powers legislatively. Congress has essentially asserted that within 100 miles of the border, CBP can do practically everything that it sees necessary in terms of keeping these streets safe and keeping federal property safe. So again, I think that you're going to see this battle happen between the local authorities in Portland and the federal authorities in Washington, D.C. And we should look at this not just as a Portland story, not just as an Oregon story, but as a national story, because I do think that if the Trump administration feels like it can get away with legally what it's doing in Portland, then it might essentially outsource or export that strategy to other cities that it thinks are acting up.
Well, let's look at it politically and maybe historically. Politically, because we know Oregon's governor and Portland's mayor, Democrats, this could appear to people as some sort of partisan vendetta. But also, if we look back, other times when federal troops have been sent by presidents in maybe uneasy times to quash a popular movement, Kent State comes to mind. And that did not end well for President Nixon, sending America's youth in the National Guard to fire on America's youth protesting. I mean, these young people in the streets in Portland are the children of people who vote.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I think that if this gets worse, then Kent State is going to be a precedent that's brought up a lot in the news. 13 students shot at Kent State. 4 of them were killed. What's happening in Portland, to me, it sets a really dangerous precedent, especially if judges essentially say that CBP is acting within its jurisdiction. The Department of Homeland Security, I think, is twisting the definition of Homeland Security and twisting its mandate beyond recognition. And it's doing so in a way that establishes a really dangerous precedent, where you essentially can have a president in almost any city within 100 miles of the border. So almost any city, so many different large U.S. cities, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, send in federal law enforcement agencies to arrest people, detain them without marked vehicles and without uniforms. So it is very, very concerning.
Yeah, we're going to leave it at that with Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And we'll wait to see what a judge does say. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.